Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck Canadians? How's it going? Where we at? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. I'm obviously, you can tell, I'm in Vancouver. I was back in LA for a bit. Now I'm up here for a bit, and I'll be back there for a bit. Just going to be the way it's going to be. And I know on some level, it may seem I've been a little ungrateful or a bit whiny or maybe a bit complainy in terms of me kind of reckoning or wrapping my head around the job of acting. But there's been some breakthroughs, people. And I know so many of you are so invested in, you know, how I handle my life or reconcile the choices I make with actually doing what those choices entail. And there's been some movement. There's been a bit of movement up here in Canada all of a sudden, and it's good. And I think that talking it out with you and talking it out with other actors and talking to myself and to Kit, that I start to understand my tone a little more, and I sometimes move away or get distracted from a general sense of gratitude that on some level I am not the luckiest man in the world, but I've definitely landed in a good place. And there's some part of me that thinks, dude, you better shut up. You better shut the fuck up. But then what would I have to say? Yeah, it's completely contradictory to saying things, which is how I make my living. But there are some things I should shut up about. Look, today on the show, we have Stavros Halkias, who is a very funny guy who I didn't know and I just liked. He's a comedian, obviously. He hosts the podcast Stavvy's World. He has a recent Netflix special out. And I don't know what it is. I'll tell you exactly what it was. The new special is called Fat Rascal. And a while back on TikTok, I did sort of a mock crowd work bit that made fun of crowd work comedians in general who may or may not be able to actually do the job of a comic, but we live in an era where publicity is actually the content. Publicity is actually the thing you're working on. That's 50% of your job, it seems, for some comics. And that's just the way it is. That, what do you do? I'm a comedian, but mostly I'm in publicity for myself. Fine. But I made a little mock thing, and then somebody commented that it seemed like something Stavros would do, and then I started to go down a little bit of a Stavros rabbit hole, and I realized I liked the guy, and I thought he was funny, and I thought he was an authentic guy. And then I watched his special, and I still enjoyed him. I liked him, and I thought, like, I'd like to sit down and talk to this guy. I don't know his whole story. I didn't know it going in. I know more now. I didn't know the world of comics he comes from, really, a bit. But I'm finding that I'm a bit out of the loop in general because I'm old. I'm two or three generations away from these guys and gals. And I can't keep up. But lately because the show has been moving, you know, we've done a lot of episodes and we've been going since 2009. And a lot of the people I talked to then were just in their 20s, young comics. So there's several generations that I haven't really talked to. So I've been trying to sort of get on board or, you know, feel the pulse of the world or watch some new stuff. And I found some people and it just seems to be happening. I do like talking to comics. I just don't know a lot of them. So Stavros was, you know, of that generation. And I got a couple other ones coming up that are just new comics. And it's good for me to watch, get out there and sort of see what's funny. Who gets me going. And this guy's one of them. And we had a lovely chat.
Before I forget, I'll be in Tucson, Arizona at the Rialto Theater on Friday, September 30th. I'm in Phoenix at the Orpheum Theater on Saturday, September 21st. You can go to WTFpod.com for all the dates. Some of them might have to be moved, but don't freak out. If anything is ever rescheduled, I will make it a point to redo it. It's just life gets a little complicated and large, and things come out of the woodwork that I have to do. And that's just the way it is, the way it works, the show business I'm in. So I'm up here in Vancouver talking about breakthroughs, and I'm trying to track the things that led up to wherever my head's at now, because all of a sudden my brain is on fire. I'm generating a lot of thoughts and things and writing things down. I know that I'm in sort of a creative zone if all of a sudden I have a lot of pieces of paper, folded up script pages that I'm using as blank papers. You know, never anything organized, never a notebook, never the notes thing on my phone, none of that. It's just scribbling. I'm always very hyper aware that I need a pen constantly, even if I don't use it. Always have a pen. Fucked up a few shirts. That's the downside of having a pen. Is that the old man didn't close it, didn't pull in the point. And look, now look what you did. You ruined another shirt. But nonetheless, last week or so, last few days, really, a lot of fucking generating's going on. A lot of things are happening in my head. And it's exciting when it happens because I can't always make it happen. And something has shifted in my attitude about what's going on, you know, in my life and about acting and about the work I'm doing, because I'm doing a lot of jobs. I do the podcast, I do the stand-up, I do this job acting. But I don't know, something gave way, something about Canada, something about what I love about being up here in the past and why I've always found it a tremendous relief, the weight of the menace and psychic fucking malignancy of America is not here. And I always recognized it and felt it in a way. And I've talked about it with you. It's just a load off. But, you know, that was only coming up here for a few days. But now that I'm spending real time here and I've kind of pushed myself out into the world, even though I'm alone, being alone for a weekend or a day or whatever in a strange town to do a road gig where you can just sort of go out and get something to eat, see a new thing, go to a museum or something, you know, that kind of comes and goes because you just go home. But to really dig in and, you know, push myself out into the world here, it's starting to kind of get comfortable. I don't love being alone for long periods of time. You know, it's hard to motivate to just go out and do stuff when you're alone. I find that, you know, usually, as I've spoken about before, what happens is I'll end up at a Whole Foods or a supermarket or buying this and that, or I'll end up, you know, chasing nicotine pouches, you know, food and nicotine. That's the driving forces right now. But it's all in the process of waiting for something to catch my brain and run with it. And that's sort of happening. And what happened with the acting recently, because I've talked about how long you have to wait to do your bit, is I think I've finally shifted my perception about spending time alone, about what the process of putting a TV show or a movie together is, my part in the process, and also trying to use that time a bit. And it just happened out of necessity. So I didn't get myself all worked up into some kind of resentful state of this or that, you know, of sort of like lack of gratitude or just, you know, aggravation in terms of waiting. And a couple of things happened that, you know, made me realize it. It was sort of a unfolding of things. You know, I was home for a few days and I wasn't supposed to be on set last week. So I wanted to stay a couple more days in LA because I wasn't working. And then there was just this process of like, they wouldn't release me because the weather's erratic up here. Through conversations, it was like, well, look, we can't release you in under 24 hours. So I just learned how to deal with that. But the real revelation was really just that, look, you know, I'm being paid to do this job. This is what the job is. This is like the context of it. You know, deal with it. It's not some imposition. It's an opportunity. Okay, so that was, and I should have known that, and that was kind of piece one. And then, like, when I do come back up here, I came back up on Thursday to do one scene on Friday, And it was, you know, towards the end of the shoot day, you know, my pickup time was like 3:30, 4 in the afternoon. I drove out to the set and it was really just me exiting the RV in a situation. It was really just a shot of me exiting the RV that is a big part of the show. And there's a situation around that. And it seemed like on the page that there was nothing really there other than they need this shot because, you know, I got to walk out. It's part of the story. But within the scene, which was literally probably 12 seconds, 15 seconds of screen time, you know, I impulsively but deliberately made some choices of action. And this is really talking about, you're talking about 15 seconds. And, you know, my job is to act this thing and to be in this character and to do what this character does. And then there's party that thinks like, well, it's like 15 seconds. I mean, what is there to do? And I made some decisions about that 15 seconds. And they were impulsive, but choices to sort of land this non-speaking 15 second moment of exiting a vehicle. And it was a good choice. Well, I don't want to spoil it for anybody. It's not some big major thing that you'll notice, but I noticed it because there was business there. There was business that was in character and it was subtle, but it was what was needed to land that little piece of this show. And all of a sudden I realized, oh, that's it. That's how you got to look at this. You got to look at it as bits on some level. Each of these scenes are their own little moments or minutes that have an arc and that have a landing place. And your job is to figure out how to put that together within the character you're doing and to sort of land it. And you can feel that. And I realized, well, that's it then. And I kind of knew it, but I know it more now. That the job, even I guess whatever job you're doing, even if it's a small job, there's that moment where there's the arc of process. And then all of a sudden, there's that moment where there's where you land the fucking thing, even if it's 10 seconds. You know what I mean? So that was kind of good because it shifted my disposition around, you know, even small bits and pieces to be like, well, dude, think of it as a bit. Make the bit work. And that was a big breakthrough. I don't know if you give a shit, but that was a big breakthrough. Okay, so what happens? There's this place, Stanley Park, down here. It's a huge park, and there's a walk around it. Like, just a walk. It's like a six-mile walk, couple hours, two and a half hours. And I just head out, you know, with the AirPods and, you know, listening to a Bikini Kill because I want to wrap my brain around Bikini Kill for reasons that are obvious. And, you know, and I'm just thinking. And my brain just sort of it just opens up. It unwinds. I have these moments where, you know, I'm thinking about the script I'm working on with Lipsight, you know, based on his book. I'm thinking about the stand-up. I'm thinking about the acting choices. I'm thinking about the guests I'm going to talk to, all the stuff. And everything's just sort of, brain is wide open. And I have a moment where I'm turning a corner on the trail and I see these giant, you know, container ships. And I have this weird kind of existential moment where I realize I really don't understand much of anything. And that was brought on by the fact that, like, how do those things even float? It seems heavy. Look, that's an answerable question. I'm sure it's got something to do with design and the amount of air ratio against the water. Like, there are answers to that, but I'm like, I really don't know. It seems like a miracle. And for some reason, that was humbling. And I just finished a hike and I'm just like jamming. My brain has got all these different things in it, all these different topics. And I'm like, well, I'm going to this club tonight on Saturday, this Comedy Underground. Maybe I'll just put out a little story on Instagram to see how many people it really sees those in Vancouver and just get a few fans down there. So we, you know, it sold out. We got about 50 people down there and it was a big show. And I went out in the middle for about 15, 20. But I was working new shit in a way that is not always, you know, it's hard to do in just a regular comedy club. You need a workout space. I usually do that kind of stuff at Dynasty Typewriter. You know, just find the free zone where I can like kind of move through stuff. And I did a lot of that. And I realized like, well, these audiences are great. Here's the fucking thing about Canada and my observation about Canadians or just what I'm experiencing is that they're, you know, decency still exists here. culturally in Canada. Yeah, you know, for a lot of reasons, and you know, I can try to explore it or speculate, but you know, the people here, because of the tone of the culture, are just, you know, they're decent people and they're polite people. And I'm not saying everybody, and there's certainly their problems, but there is sort of an openness and a lack of aggressive entitlement and self-servingness and, you know, need to disrupt or be a fucking dick shamelessly. It's not up here. That those are all sort of, you know, byproducts of the cultural condition of America. And it just isn't here. So there was a moment where, you know, I can make judgments about people by their appearance in terms of like, oh, that guy looks like he's going to be difficult. But I'm always wrong up here. And there's just a space up here where they're engaged. This was my experience. And it's possible to sort of push through ideas and without the weight of the constant garbage that is, you know, particles of the air, like Reichian orgone. You know, there's just this unspecific thing in the fucking air in the States that just doesn't hear. It just isn't here. There's just something about it. And I just think I felt like, well, this is it, man. You know, you weren't romanticizing, you know, this idea of Canada. This is culturally more, I don't know if it's advanced, but more just down to earth and decent and tolerant. And it was just like a major breakthrough. It's very exciting. So here are the beats. I'm grateful for my job. I have found a way to experience focus and joy within what I'm doing in my role. And my appreciation for what really is my experience of Canada in terms of the people and the possibilities exploded. And along with all those lines, my brain was jamming for the last 3 days. And I've probably got about a good 20 minutes of ideas to kind of fuck around with on stage. So if you're invested in my process or my progress, that's where we're at. All right, here we go. Stavros Halkias, great guy, funny guy. Real dude, authentic guy. His podcast, Stavi's World, is available on all podcast platforms, and he has a members-only feed on Patreon. His Netflix special is called Fat Rascal, and this is him and I hanging out.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Yeah, I've been off nicotine for like 3 years, and like I'll do it anyway, yeah, anyway it sure comes, but not cigarettes anymore. And like, I know about what drugs and addiction are, right? So I got these and I put one in. I'm like, oh, these are great. They got a nice pace to them.
Yeah.
You know, like I'll probably do like 4 or 5 a day.
Yeah.
And the next
yeah
thing you know, I'm stockpiling them
because
you can't get flavors here anymore. Yeah. So I go out of town, I'm bringing flavors home.
Yeah,
and then
flavors.
Here's how you know you're a fucking drug addict is you start finding the used ones just around, like, you know, under a pillow,
yeah,
on the ground.
Tough.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, what? How are these getting?
Yeah.
It's some version of just empty bottles around the house.
I fully understand. I mean, I am a straight food addict. That's my main thing. And I know.
Fucking love it.
I know the, like, easy slide into.
Totally.
Where it's like, oh, well, I can get bacon on this chicken. You know what I mean? It's like, it's fine. I have the calories. I'm putting it in my fitness tracker app, you know? And then it's like, and then it just slowly goes, and you're up to 2 pints of Ben and Jerry's a day, and you're getting whole sandwiches as side dishes. The mental gymnastics it takes to do, like, hey, I'm going to actually get tenders instead of fries, because they're both fried, so that cancels out.
Right.
And white chicken breast. That's healthy.
Sure,
and then it's like, you know what I mean? And then you don't think about a sauce. Oh. It's fucked up. I'm trying to get my shit. It's so hard to just. I'm trying to get on the you know on the rails with my
food?
Eating right now. I get the addiction thing. I truly do.
Well, oddly, and I don't know if you're going to believe me, but I have like massive fucking food issues.
I can see that.
You know, just mentally.
Yeah.
But I go the other way. I'm more like I'll go into total like restriction and just crazy control freak shit.
Yeah.
But I used to do the 2 pints. My mother was like had eating disorder, so I was brought up with it.
Right.
Like when most kids were, you know, learning how to read, you know, books. I was, you know, calorie counting. I learned how to do. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. No. She, she had. You know, I was that kid, and my mom would be like, "Where's the husky section?"
Interesting.
So,
were you a fat kid or no?
Just a little chubby. When you have an anorexic mother,
right?
Like any bit of fat.
We had a kid growing up like that where it was like they would like, it was fucked up where I think his mom was fat.
Yeah, that's what my mom and was then, and then got.
Got super skinny. Yeah. And then, well, she married some guy who was just an abusive, fucking horrible piece of shit.
Yeah.
And that spurred her on to lose weight. And to her, that was like, oh, this is how you treat people now. And so it was like, I was fat as shit. It was great because I would go to their house.
Yeah.
And her like weird, you know, mom, like these kids, we'd be eating like Oreos and their mom would come in and they'd be like, fuck. They'd start getting like scared, dude. They would not be like, what the fuck's the big deal? And it was awesome because they did, I don't know. I had some perverse, because my mom was the best. I mean, my mom, we have addiction issues in our side of the family, in her side of the family from drinking.
Yeah.
And I don't think she put it together. She thought as long as you aren't drinking, you're fine.
Right.
And so I think she has food issues and I think I definitely got those and my dad has his own stuff. So, but my mom was just a super, like a caricature of an Eastern European, like loving mother.
Who,
snacks, treats, bakes. My friends would
readily
come over
available.
And she'd bake shit. Oh, constantly.
Yeah.
So I had the opposite of body issues.
Right. But it was like
for my family. So
my mom used to hide my dad, you know, who's a fucking nut. You know, he was allowed to eat cookies and ring dings or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
So she would hide them. Like my mom was like, there's a story that my cousin tells where he was out visiting us in Albuquerque where I grew up. And there was a party the night before and there was half a chocolate cake left. And the next day he wanted to go have a slice of chocolate cake and my mother was just like shoving it into the garbage disposal.
Oh no.
Like she would just, you know, she would eat and throw things away.
Well, I get that too because there's no, I know the feeling of throwing it away isn't doing anything.
Like it's so weird with food. I can't throw anything. It has to smell pretty bad. Because I try to cook, you know, for myself and cook healthy. But here's the thing about the addiction part. With the ice cream, because I used to do it. And like for me with dairy, it's like it becomes about my heart now or whatever. I'm totally vegan.
Yeah.
Which I used to do a bit about this, which I used to say it's an ideological eating disorder.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So, you know, but the Ben and Jerry's thing, I would do that. I would plow through a pint or 2 pints. But that feeling you get, because you know.
Yeah.
Like that whole fucking thing. I did a bit on it years ago where, you know, you do the thing where I'm like, I'm just going to have a little bit and put it away.
Of course. Come on.
But then you go back and
you're never.
And then at some point, you just got to like, just enjoy it, you fuck.
Yeah.
And that feeling of like, keep going.
Totally. And halfway in, you don't even want it anymore. But it's like, what? I'm going to get up and put it away?
Yeah, but
at that point, it becomes. And then you trick yourself. You're like, well, I don't want it. I just don't want to put it back. And so that gets you through. That lets you push through to the next level. So then you're like, oh,
yeah.
4 spoonfuls in, I'm back in, baby. I just needed that little boost to fucking get me through.
But like, where are you with it now?
I am tracking my eating just because I feel like I need to get kind of.
What do you use to do that?
My Fitness Pal.
I was using that.
Yeah.
I love doing that.
Yeah.
I used to do fucking Weight Watchers back in
Me
the old
too,
days.
Dude, I was a Weight Watchers kid.
So,
I had a
with the numbers? With just the numbers?
Yeah, with the numbers.
That was the best.
Point
now
system.
I don't even know what the fuck they're doing over there now. Yeah. I just like the math of it. It's like an equation of control.
Yeah.
And then you figure out, you know, how many no-point foods you can eat.
And then you just
fucking eat and like,
go,
you know,
crazy
like,
on grapes and shit like that. I remember I was like the fat little mascot of, because I was a boy with my mom. And that was like, my mom was just trying to, because I never got it from my mom, but you know, the world,
right.
You're going to get body image issues from the world. Even
so,
if
when were you? When did you? When did you start with the fat?
Oh, dude, there's never been. You know, there's never not. I don't know any other reality. I don't know. I mean, I do think the I trace it back to. I went to public school in Baltimore, and my mom would give me milk money in a very classic way.
Yeah.
But what she didn't realize is that there was, you could just, people were giving away milk. Nobody fucking wanted milk.
Yeah, you know.
So there was a table that gave away milk.
Yeah.
And there was like an old Greek lady that was just selling unregulated pastries. That was like her job. She sold the children. They just let her in. She's not an educator, no credentials.
Street pastries?
Yeah, just like out of her fucking dirty tins from like the 40s probably. This woman was ancient in the 90s, right? So, and she's just selling little brownies that she made, and that's how she's making ends meet. It's kind of crazy that the school system just let this woman who was not affiliated with, not
a
teacher.
A public school?
Public school. And I would take my 25 cents and get a brownie every day.
Yeah.
And I never told my mom because the milk was free. I could I could finesse my way into
but
a milk.
But she wouldn't have, would she have had a problem with it?
I think she just wouldn't have given me. She would have been like, it's for milk.
No quarter.
It was, yeah. No, she would have taken it back.
Yeah.
It was, and it was more just like, well, you don't need that kind of thing. She wouldn't, you know, she wouldn't. But it was like, and then I just, that's probably, I'm talking first grade.
Yeah.
And I got on a cupcake or brownie a day.
Fucking street brownie.
Just straight up, you know.
You found the brownie dealer.
It was, and that's the beginning. I mean, I was always a husky kid. And then, And then it was just like, you know. And then I was, you know, I just, and then I just been on the road so long and
it's
completely fucked my life up.
It can be bad out there.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's great. It's
for
it's,
food, I mean. I mean, like, because, like, you can't, like, now I'm doing the vegan thing. It's like, it's impossible because all these vegan places are like vegan junk food. So they're trying to make hamburgers and fried shit.
Sure.
But, like, even if you try to eat healthy on the road, if you don't go to, like, that Whole Foods salad bar and just
fucked.
Fucking manage it, everything's just soaked. I don't even know how it happens. But you eat anything at a restaurant.
Yeah.
It's like they inject
calories.
Yeah, they inject calories.
Yeah.
You don't even know why.
Oil, butter. The thing I like about tracking calories right now is because it just reminds me what a portion is.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I cooked a ribeye, and I was so pumped. I'd been good for weeks. I was like, let me grill a little steak.
Yeah.
And I measured it out, and I fucking started crying because it was like a third of the steak. And I have my whole evening. I'm like, let's go.
Like a bone in?
Boneless, but a nice big cut, you know, dry age, the good shit.
Yeah.
And I was like, I measure out my potato, and I'm like, this is great. Now let me just get, I'm sure it's not going to be as big as I like.
Yeah.
It was one third of the steak that I would usually eat. And to be fair, every time I would eat a steak like that, I'm in pain for, know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like you're sweating.
But
whatever.
You ate it all, right?
I actually did. I'm good now. I mean, you know.
Yeah?
Right now,
what'd you do with
the
rest of the cooked steak?
It went in the fridge, and I sliced it up, and
for
I had
sandwich?
A little sandwich the next day, a little open face with a little avocado,
good.
You know, some fucking...
Healthy oils.
Yeah, some avocado oil.
With the pure fat.
Yeah. It's also very easy, because I got fat as hell, to just, as long as you're not really...
Bigger than now?
This is it. I mean, you're seeing, this is the top, right? I mean, I'm down 20 pounds to what I was
that's great.
A couple months ago, but that was the thing where I was like, Jesus fucking... And when you're so in the zone with... I just got successful in a way I'd never expected to.
Yeah.
And it was like my health and everything else in my life stopped mattering. And I was like, let's see, I guess. I can just be like, I truly could not believe I was doing theater. Like it was I did a theater tour last year and I was like, I was confused the first like 4 months. I was like, every time I'm like, why are we doing these? Yeah. Like, I'm asking my agent, I'm like, why am I not in a club?
Yeah.
This
but you're
crazy.
On stage going, are you sure you're in the right place?
Dude, and my fans are dirtbags and they're in these chandeliers. Yeah. I'm a piece of shit.
Yeah.
We don't belong there. And it was like, I just couldn't believe anything that was happening for so long. So I was like, I guess I'll keep doing this. And, you know, as soon as you get any success, you're like, well, I can't stop or. I know.
Like, this is my window.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, you got to think about it like that, I think. You know, and I
think, unfortunately, you do. And so I guess my hope is, and so I just let into all my vices. I just let them ride because I needed to get through that.
Like, what'd you do? Like, what else?
You know,
did you buy a car?
Eating, what's that?
Did you buy a car?
I didn't buy, no, I mean just like while traveling.
With the food.
food. I'm just getting nicer, you know, I'm staying in nice hotels.
Sure, fly first.
You know, flying first.
Yeah.
Well, it started as a luxury and then it became,
like, I'm not
if you don't
coach
put me in fucking, I'll kill myself. If I like, I'm not just for me, for the guy next to me. Like, there's no worse, sometimes I, you know, certain weird cities, you got to fly Southwest.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no funnier feeling
than
it's a full flight.
Yeah.
I'm in the back. I got an aisle.
Yeah.
And the guy, the people that just, you watch them realize their fate when they see the empty seat next to me, and then you see them fucking panic and look around. They look behind them, and, you know, you can't go. People see, and they just start sitting down. They're like, fuck, it's me and him the whole time. And I don't want to be, you know, if I could. People talk about, like, fat people should buy two seats. I would love to buy two seats.
Yeah.
There's no, you can't just go, like, two seats, please.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a fucking option on any website.
Do you have to ask for the special seatbelt thing?
I don't. I do a move where I just wear a loose sweater over top.
Yeah.
Leave enough plausible deniability that it's buckled.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't want to bring it up. I don't want to bring it up. You know, I'm nice to them. I strike up a rapport with them.
Right, right.
I'm not a dick. So that if push comes to shove, and I've even seen them.
Yeah.
Like, look, and here's what I've learned.
Yeah.
The nicest, you can't make it obvious. So if it's swinging on the side, you got to tuck it in.
Yeah.
You got to tuck it under your
sweater.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You got to use your flaps to hold it in place so that the stewardess can't see it. She knows it's not buckled. She's aware how fat you are. She knows what the length of their seatbelt. So I try and, like, you know, I'm like, what is the seatbelt really going to do? I'm jammed in here pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If somebody doesn't need it, it's me, you know? Oh, it's brutal asking for that. Or when you get a real, like, new stickler that really wants to.
Yeah, wants to. I'm sorry, sir, but we have to.
Come on, what are we doing?
They got to walk down. Now you're in the back of the plant. You got to walk down the aisle with the strap.
The strap is brutal. I just got to get out of the strap zone. Yeah. That's the first. I have such. My health goals have gone from, like, be ripped to, like, do not need extra material to fasten your airplane seatbelt. I want to be able to go to Thailand with anybody assuming I'm a sex criminal.
Yeah.
Because you can't be a fat guy in a Hawaiian that says he wants to go to Thailand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it looks, the beaches look nice.
I hear it's beautiful.
You know? Yeah. So anyway, it's, like, very manageable, small stuff I'm trying to get to.
But, like, in this, like, well, I mean, you're the general, like, there's part of me coming into this interview because, like, what got me involved with watching your shit was because I can't keep up.
Sure.
You're probably two generations behind me. I mean, how old are you?
I'm 35.
Yeah. So, like, you know, I'd like to know who's what and what's going on. But, like, there was a time where I knew everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew the old guys that were before me.
Right.
And I knew my guys. And then all of a sudden it's like, I've got to surrender the fact.
I get it.
That I'm an old fuck.
and I'm
a little out of the loop.
Of course.
I mean, we're doing an audio podcast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah, no, it's crazy. Like, I was like, oh, fucking no camera, nothing.
You're great.
Don't even have to worry about
but
shit.
I do need you to wear the seatbelt extender.
Yeah, I'm strapped in here tight.
I'd done some, it wasn't even with any sort of bitterness, but because I don't do a lot of TikTok, I have a guy doing it, putting the old clips up. But, like, I, you know, it was like, all you hear about these crowd work videos, right?
Yeah,
so did one. I did a crowd work video to sort of, like, you know, end all. It was like, it was just an idea, a satire where I'm going to do pure crowd work. I'm going to break it down to what it is. And I just, like, I ask someone in the front row, what's your name? He says his name. I go, that's fucking stupid.
And then, like, and then what it is. See a guy with a shirt, say the shirt's too small, you're gay.
But it was just
classics,
that. There was no nuance to it.
Of course.
So I put that up, and it got a lot of fucking hits for me.
Yeah.
And then someone just sort of, like, Stavros. It's like Stavros. And, like, I'm like, who the fuck is, you know, what is this guy? Like, I kind of knew who you were.
Sure.
But they were literally saying, like, you know, he does this.
Yeah.
But it was not like what you do. But then, so I watched your special, the newest one is very funny.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
And I like your disposition, and I'm like, I'm going to talk to this guy and figure out what the fuck has happened. Maybe you can help the old man.
I don't know either is the thing. Like, this is all a complete mistake.
But let's go back. So TikTok, you grew up where?
I grew up in Baltimore.
Baltimore?
Yeah.
Like, how close to D.C.?
About an hour. I mean, I was in Baltimore City, so Southeast Baltimore, and it was, and I, you know.
Well, I know, I have no idea about that city. The last time I talked about Baltimore in any real way was David Simon, and that's a deep conversation.
Of course, of course.
That's a very nuanced and multi-leveled, you know, he is The Wire.
For sure. I mean, my season two of The Wire is where I grew up.
Which season was that?
That's the Greeks, right?
Oh, okay.
So I grew up in Greektown in Baltimore.
So is that like one of the big Greek populations? Like, because I lived in Astoria for years.
Yeah, you know, it's funny.
What?
I think I sublet the apartment. I think you had like there was 8 subleases, and at the top was you. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I was on 37th.
37th. That's the fucking one, dude. I got bed bugs in your old apartment.
Yeah, I mean, I had bed bugs in that apartment.
they've been around that long.
Well, who'd you sublease from, Leo?
I think my friends were subleasing from Leo, and I was renting a room for
this
a month.
This is crazy.
From them. This is 10 years ago, 9 years ago.
That's crazy. Yeah. But was Carlo still the landlord?
I don't even know. I never made contact with
him. No, it must have been after, because like I had it for years.
Yeah.
And I love that place. I mean, when I got that place, it's a 2-bedroom with a fucking kitchen.
Yeah, it was
in that little bedroom, and then there's the big bedroom.
I was in the little bedroom.
Yeah, that's where, you know, I went through, well, what happened was, I'll give you the whole history of that fucking apartment.
Yeah, because
I got it from a guy who was a writer, and I got on the lease. The guy Carlos used to be the landlord. He was a Dominican dentist.
Oh, I think we had a Greek guy.
No, there's a Greek guy, but here's what happened. Yeah. So we had this Dominican dentist. He was funny because Jody Lennon, did you know her? She lives downstairs, Chicago. No. She's still there.
Oh, okay.
She was in Exit 57, improv sketch person. But she said Carlos came into her apartment because her oven wasn't working, and he said, if it was a mouth, I could fix it.
So he was poetic.
Yeah. And so he's a Dominican dentist who, you know, he didn't go back to school in the States to get you know, but so he had a little, like, he worked out too much.
Sure.
So I subleased it to a musician for a while. I kept hold of it because I actually ended up needing it. So I had it from, like, fucking 95 until Leo came in.
Okay.
And I let him live there. And then apparently Carlos sold the building, and he came up to Leo and said, are you Mark? And Leo's like, Mark's out of town. He's no, you're the guy now. Like, that was it.
Wow.
Like, there was no negotiating.
I live in Astoria, too, so I subleased, and I've actually been in the same apartment. Since I left your place, I've been in the same apartment for 9 years now. So I love Astoria.
I loved
it. And that's how those landlords work.
Yeah.
I signed one lease 1 year. Haven't even spoken about it since.
Yeah,
it's like that kind of handshake agreement.
Is it a rent control? Stabilized?
It is because I have a landlord who doesn't give a fuck.
Mine was stabilized. It wasn't rent control, but they could only raise it incrementally. They couldn't raise it,
He's never raised it. It's insane.
It's fucking great.
He doesn't fix anything. But
Greek guy?
No, I think he's Indian.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that.
If it was a Greek guy, he would lower the rent every year for me. Greek people fucking love Greek people, man. It's awesome.
Yeah?
Yeah, they'll hook you up.
I mean, that apartment was crazy because I know they redid it and they cleaned it up. Dude, when I was in that apartment.
That's crazy. You had fucking bed bugs.
That's the story.
Yeah.
I didn't have them for years.
Them. Yeah.
And then, like, I subleased it to this German photographer woman who was my roommate briefly, but that went the wrong way.
Yeah.
But she ended up staying there.
Wow.
And then she got, that's when they started. But that was during the bed bug craze.
Bitch. Yeah.
No, she didn't. Okay. It wasn't her fault. Okay, but like what happens is it's like if they're in the fucking building, like I went nuts.
Yeah,
I sealed everything, put everything in plastic.
It was fucked up.
Sealed up the fucking mattress. It makes you crazy.
Ruined my, literally for 5 years, I would wake up with like itching something that
wasn't
there.
Did you see them ever?
I never saw
that's
them.
That's the fucking thing. So I actually met people that lost their minds thinking they had them.
Yeah, that's what happened to me. I've thrown away beds. When I was broke, I just fucking threw them away because I was like, I got them. And then I got metal bed for a while. I was like, metal? Because they can't get on fucking metal. They can get on wood.
You didn't wrap the mattress with the ceiling?
Had the wrap.
But the thing is, I never got one fucking bite. They like women more than men.
They fucked me up.
Oh, they bit the fuck.
I remember, because my friends who I was subleasing to, comics, we had moved kind of together. They had moved ahead of me, and And, you know, they were just, they were doing better, you know, Last Comic Standing, somebody got it on the Tonight Show.
Right.
So I was like, oh, they know what the fuck they're doing. And meanwhile, they were just getting fucked up, not doing shit. They were just kind of riding the wave.
Well, those things don't mean anything ultimately.
But when you're an open micer, of you're course. Like, oh, they're fake. You know, they know what the fuck they're
doing. They made $600.
they got to fly themselves to L.A. to bomb in front of Roseanne. but I remember, and I was like, and we would just be, you know, we're just doing open mics,
getting
fucked at the creek, drinking tall boys.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, these mosquitoes at the creek backyard are fucking me up. I'm like, this is crazy because they'd gotten all over me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, God, I'm like, guys, are they fucking you up? They're like, no, not really. And I even floated to them. I was like, do you guys think we have bed bugs? They're like, no, no way.
Yeah.
And then after I had moved, thank God I had 1-2 week other bridge sublease.
Right.
Where they were like, hey, man, we lifted the mattresses, and they said they was fucking crawling. Like, it was atrocious with bed bugs.
And at my old place?
At your old place. It had gotten fucking bad. And I had to fumigate everything. And this is, again, I just moved to New York. The place I was planning to live in was a 3-bedroom, where I still am now, 3-bedroom that we turned into a 4-bedroom because I just took the corner of the living room for $500 a month. Like, I had convinced my friends. We put a fake wall up, actually.
Huh.
Pretty bougie, yeah. It cost me another $700.
Yeah.
But I moved there with, like, $3,000 in the bank.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had to fumigate all my shit, $750. It fucking destroyed. I was like, this is it. I'm ruined financially.
Yeah.
I got a shitty writing job
right
soon after. But it was like that, those bed bugs, the same bed bugs that tormented you fucked me up my first year in New York. They were the bane of my existence.
Well, I mean, because if they don't do the whole fucking building.
No, they did it. They went apartment by apartment and it was just.
I remember I had some guy come over, some East Asian guy. And with the fumigator, and he was wheezing, like, and he was complaining how they couldn't use DDT anymore. He said, that's what kills him, this stuff. I thought he was going to die in my fucking apartment.
Yeah. That's a man who loves the game. He loves exterminating.
Yeah, yeah, but he's been doing it so long he remembers DDT.
right.
And now he's like, he's hobbled. It's like doctors and healthcare systems that can't treat people the way they want to because they're restricted. This guy's like, it's not like it used to be.
Let's get this red tape out of the way.
I bet you if I gave him a few bucks, he'd go down to the truck.
He could find
get
some
the DDT. So Baltimore
DDT.
Greeks. Is it as big a Greek community as Astoria?
It's not as big as Astoria. In fact, when I was growing up, they would take us, my Greek school, like my church, that community, we would take field trips to New York, and we would go to the Met and see, like, the Greek statues, and then they would take us to Astoria.
Yeah.
They would, like, fuck New York, fuck Central Park.
Yeah.
You don't need to go to Broadway. It's like, we'll go see some Greek statues, and then you'll go to Astoria and
see
eat
Greeks.
A fucking gyro. Yeah, it was fucking ridiculous.
And try to understand how these people made those.
Yeah.
I used to do a joke about that. You know, like, how did they get from, you know, creating, you know, the Parthenon to, like, do you want cheese?
We've been coasting on the marbles for a while.
Yeah.
You know, fuck it. We did. Who else got those motherfuckers?
Did you go to, like, Kiklides?
Yep, I would go there a lot.
The Greek seafood, man, is the fucking best.
It's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, man, I go to the one with, I go to New York, well, I'm a vegan now, which is, this is the one great loss. The Kiklides octopus is the fucking best.
Greek octopus is so
good, and then just the beets with the garlic.
Sure,
It's the fucking best.
The
horta.
Horta,
yes.
Yep.
You know what's the best thing in the world is galak de burko.
Oh, galak de burko. Dude,
you're speaking
my language here. Literally, you're literally speaking my language. But my mom was a Greek waitress at a Greek restaurant, and so much of my formative child, another addiction where the addiction started.
Well, galak de burko in itself.
It's cream, honey, and phyllo. And butter.
Like so in a little, isn't semolina flour in the custard?
You'll throw a little semolina.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
When I first had that dessert, I was like, what is this?
It's fucking incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. And
it's the best.
Because, like, I'm like a rice pudding guy. Like, I like diner rice pudding.
It's the best parts of rice pudding.
Yeah. In a phyllo with it. Oh, shit.
It's so good. But it's big.
Your parents were first generation?
First generation. They came here in the 80s. They came here a couple years before I was born.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? Did they, do you know?
I mean, my mom's parents had emigrated here. They'd gotten to America in the 70s, maybe, when my mom had moved with them and then moved back as soon as she could, because they moved when she was like 18.
Yeah.
Horrible time to have to move. Like, yeah, as soon as you're friends, about to be an adult, yeah, you have to just start a new city or a new country.
Yeah.
And so she moved back, and I think it was just this thing of like, well, we'll go visit your family, we'll work for a year, bring money back.
Yeah.
And it was one of those. They also wanted to have kids, and I'm a in vitro kid. I'm an IVF test tube baby.
Yeah.
And that this is the 80s, right? So that technology straight up didn't exist in Greece at the time. So I think it was like a combination of just kind of—
But it was your dad's cum?
It was my mom's pussy, actually.
Yeah.
To put it in scientific terms, it was my dad's nut, A-OK.
Yeah.
But, and so they were, they just had to fucking stay and figure it out.
Yeah.
And,
are you the only kid?
I have two brothers after me.
All in vitro?
All in vitro.
Yeah. Oh, it really worked.
It worked, bro, yeah. And so we they just kind of stuck around, but it was never a plan. So we don't have any of that American dream shit.
Yeah.
My father resents America.
What does he do?
He's a carpenter.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Was he build tables?
He'll build tables.
Yeah?
He's good. He's an incredible, he's incredibly talented at carpentry, not the best businessman kind of kind of vibe.
Yeah.
But yeah, my mom repaired rugs and was a waitress and, you know, worked at a dental lab. And now it's just kind of
no repaired. Restaurant. Is that racist?
We didn't, my dad built it, but it was, that's the thing. No restaurant, but we're the second. It's not racist because the whole Greek town economy was built around restaurants. So my dad is a carpenter who mostly made
booths
and fucking bars and, you know, all this kind of shit and like chairs. And my mom worked at was a waitress at Icarus in Baltimore for years.
What do you know about that? Why restaurants? Because like, you know, on the East Coast, they run the best restaurants. Like you could go to diners, which don't exist anywhere else.
Yeah.
Because in the East Coast, people eat at them. So there's turnover. Yeah. Like, you know, you get the fresh fish, but they know how to run a restaurant.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
I did a little research into this. I was kind of into, I wanted to do research about my neighborhood growing up when I was younger, when I thought I went to school for like, you know, media, political science, history, all that kind of stuff. And so I was trying to figure that out. And I think it's just a matter of, it was like the quickest way you could just become
established.
Yeah, it was like you could just start a business. You know what I mean? Like Greek people, I don't know where that started. I don't know why in Greece, I don't know where that heritage comes from. But when Greeks got here, they started doing service industry stuff because there was no barriers to entry. You don't have to work at somebody's laundromat. You can just open your, you know what I mean?
Working a little bit at a restaurant and they're like, exactly. I can do this.
And yeah, exactly. And you know, and there are a ton of restaurants in Greece that it's not about the high turnover. So I'm sure it was just a simple, they just went to the stuff that they could be small business owners from the jump.
It's so wild because it's not an easy racket restaurant.
Yeah, it's really not.
And like the diner thing, like they're almost all Greek and you know, you can't, the reason that shit exists on the East Coast is because people go there. You got to have the turnover.
Yeah.
You know, you got to have the traffic or else the fish is going to go bad.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
So they got to be good restaurants.
I do think diners, it's tough to find a good one anymore. And I think it's mostly breakfast stuff. I'm not getting fucking fish at a diner.
No?
I'm not getting, you know, I'm not, the same place I get like, you know, eggs and chocolate chip pancakes.
I overcame that because I used to think diners were only for that. But then, you know, if you spend enough time in Astoria, like right there, that like across the street was the Marino Brothers fish.
Right.
So like I knew, unlike anywhere else, that, you know, that fish would come in that day.
Right.
Like in like bluefish. Who the fuck eats bluefish? You do in Astoria because when bluefish is fresh, it's kind of oily, but it's great.
Yeah.
But you don't get it anywhere else because it's like pigeon fish. No one gives a fuck.
Yeah.
So I always felt that you know, this shit was moving because of the old people, but maybe your generation, like the old people are gone.
Yeah. I would never eat, and I'm a diner guy, but I would not eat.
Dinner?
I would not eat I'm not going to the fourth and fifth pages of the diner menu.
Huh.
I'm staying up top. I'm going breakfast.
Like that's breakfast.
That is again. That's more fat shit than anything. Like that's when you're just like, I gotta feel alive.
Yeah.
Like getting like a crab cake from a diner or getting like a ribeye, getting a steak from
a
diner.
I won't get a steak, but like I'll get fish in Astoria.
Interesting.
Just because I just feel like the fish comes in right there. It's coming in off Long Island.
I don't know.
I mean, yeah. Just get all the Atlantic fish. I don't know. Maybe I was eating fucking mackerel. I didn't give a shit. Just cooking it at home.
I'll eat a little mackerel, but.
Do you ever go to that Greek supermarket down there?
Titan.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I love that place.
It's like 100 fetus.
Yeah, it's like, incredible.
What the fuck is that?
I do feel at home there. I love. And that is really why when I first moved to New York, my best friend growing up, she had moved like a little bit before. She wanted to be, you know, New York, fashion, yeah. Wanted to work in fashion, all this kind of stuff. And the only place we knew was Astoria, and she moved there, and then I just moved in with her, and we got a place together, and now I've just kind of been there. And it does feel at home. I mean, there is something to, you know, hearing, you'll still, it's not as Greek as it was,
but yeah.
There's an elderly Greek couple arguing, reminds me of my grandparents, you know what I mean?
Well, I think they owned a lot of the real estate. I think, yeah, in terms of living, not unlike any immigrant group, they eventually move out into the island or whatever.
Happens. Yeah.
Yeah, because like, over in Queens, like from block to block, you're like, what is this?
Yeah.
I never thought that it could possibly get hip. Did it get hip or did...
It'll never get fully hip.
It won't, right?
Even though it's kind it almost... It was threatening to, and then it
but
just...
But Long Island City kind of went
LIC fucking stinks.
There's nothing there.
It's corporate. It's like, you know, it's honestly a lot of rich, like a rich Koreans live.
Who
get right into, like...
Into the new high-rises over there?
New high-rises.
Because there's like four blocks of old buildings there, and that's it.
It's all new high-rises. I have a buddy who moved to LIC, and it's literally, he's the only non-Asian person.
Oh, interesting.
And they don't like him. And he'll catch... And it is like very Asian to the point where you want to talk about like your... The fat standards.
Yeah.
They're kind of like your mother's where it's like he's caught a pudgy Chinese guy eating in the stairwell so that his wife won't catch him. He's caught him six times to the point where my buddy's like, I feel like if we started kissing, it wouldn't be weird. Like I've caught him in like a forbidden situation so many times it's like there's something, an electricity in the air. But it's like that. And my buddy's straight. They're both ostensibly straight men. Yeah. But even he's like, I'm feeling something. Yeah. Man. This is like, and then he caught him in the gym once, and it's like, oh,
eating?
Man, eating while my buddy went to go get a workout, and it's so, this poor guy. But that's what LIC,
there's that vulnerability of being caught, you know, in that moment where it's sort of like, hey, I'm out here, there's no limits anymore.
No, it happens once, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Happens twice, you're like, huh. He's five times, it's like, is he wanting to get caught by him? Does he know when my buddy's coming?
Of course, the shame is part of it.
shame is so powerful. You could take that, you could ride that anywhere.
Oh yeah. I mean, they're hand in hand. Like, yeah. You're riding that speedball of shame and satisfaction.
Yeah.
So you got older siblings?
I'm the oldest.
Oh, you're the oldest?
Yeah.
And so what happened? How do you get into the comedy racket? After college, you finished college?
I didn't actually. I
got an incomplete?
I started, yeah. So I have all my credits except my language credits, and I'm fluent in Greek.
Yeah.
And I got to basically the point, I only went to college because my mom wanted me to, basically.
Yeah.
I got a scholarship to a local UMBC.
What were you studying?
I was studying history, political science, media. I got a public affairs scholarship.
Yeah.
Out of high school. Yeah. And I was like kind of a history dork, and I was like, you know, interested in like, you know, growing up in Baltimore City, I was like, I want to change things.
Sure.
And then I'm like, I'd rather just talk about how little my dick is at a wing restaurant. That's how I'd like to spend my 20s, actually.
Smaller than the wings?
Yeah, well, I guess depends. Depends on what size wings and what state my penis is in. So typically, no, I'd like to say, but... and so, you know, I started doing open mics in college, and I was like, this is the best thing. I love doing this. This rocks. I knew I wanted to do comedy. It was so clear. This was the only thing I've
ever
liked.
Any of the guys that you were with keep going? In the open mics?
In the open mic, the guys, I mean, there was a ton of people that were pretty funny. I mean, I met Wardell when he was like 16.
Yeah.
And you know, so I actually drove here with him when he, you know, I was like 20 or
Wardell?
Yeah, Brandon Wardell.
Yeah.
So he was like, you know, this little this child that had like 15 nice minutes, and you know, and, yeah. and we were boys. Still to this day, we're boys. He's, you know, the guys. A lot of people that I came up with. I mean, Jamel Johnson is still out here. He's hilarious.
Yeah,
but it was like a lot. The people kind of right in front of us. There was a, you know, I had just missed like Rory Scovel, Aparna Nancherla, Hampton.
The guys I knew came out of there. We two of them moved to San Francisco at the same time I did back in. 92, Blaine Kapach, Patton Oswalt.
Yeah, they were. I knew those guys, and it was cool. I was like, "Oh, those guys."
And they used to mythologize this one guy from Baltimore that I don't know how long the myth lasted, but some guy named Mark Voice.
I don't know Mark.
Yeah, he's that poor guy.
We have our own guys.
Lost
the time. Yeah, we've got our guy. Was he like kind of a?
Yeah, on the edge.
Actually, funny or not funny?
I heard he was funny. I think he passed away.
Oh, that's
but
a
like
bummer.
He got out of the racket, but he was one of those. There's always that guy. Yeah, you know, that guy.
He
could have
done. Oh, that. Oh, so we had a lot of like ironic.
Oh no!
Like out of their minds.
Right.
Don't know what's going on.
Right.
Baltimore was great for that.
Yeah.
But no, we you know we.
Like I miss that part of comedy. It's not. It doesn't have. Yeah, I think that's
it is
something
fun.
The phone ruined. Was people snapping?
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah.
And mentally ill people that couldn't manage it.
Right.
Like they were always around.
Right,
you know, like
it was their only outlet.
Yeah.
They couldn't post about, you know, their chakras.
Yeah.
They couldn't go live and tell you about the kind of how alkaline water is killing
but
you.
But also like the fact that people record now like has changed the standards of comedy and also no one's willing to lose their fucking mind anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Because someone's gonna get it.
Right.
And
then
you're gonna be known for that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do like that it was such an outlet. And I like that there's zero barrier to entry. I like that
literally any bum off the street could do it.
If you could figure it out. Yeah.
You know, all you got to do is be funny. And you're not getting paid at that level.
No.
So you got to get through 3 to 5 minutes.
Yeah. It was awesome. It was the best. And you would get the most insane people.
I'm going to D.C. and this week.
Oh, nice.
Saturday night at the Warner Theater.
Great. That's awesome, man.
Yeah. I did all right. I've done better there, but I'll take it.
You'll do it. Yeah, you got a couple days.
Yeah, I mean, you know. You get to a point, like you're doing theaters now, where you're like, I only saw 1,300?
Yeah.
It's like the seat's like 1,800.
I know. It's in the sentences that have come out of my mouth where it was like, my goal, like everything feels like I'm playing with house money now.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I just wanted to headline C and B rooms across America.
Yeah.
Like, I started at Magoobie's Joke House. I wanted to play every Magoobie's Joke House in every city in America. I wanted to creak out a living at $70,000 before taxes.
Yeah.
Like, that was to me what I had no idea of podcasting. I mean, honestly, your podcast, when I was starting, I listened to it. I actually used to listen to The Sound of Young America, like Jesse Thorne. And
I
remember those guys were like,
he's the guy who told me to get these mics.
That's what I was, I remember that. And he almost like said, you should go check out our friend Mark Maron's podcast. Like I was literally listening to some other podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
The first one you did was like you and Patton on like a,
right?
On like a computer, I feel like. Right. Like it was like, and so I liked your podcast as a like, whoa, this is a cool insight into
comedy.
What comedy was like. Because when you're, especially when you're starting and you just can't get enough of comedy, it was timing wise perfect. And then eventually I just stopped listening to any comedy podcast because like, I got into the like, I don't want anyone to influence me zone.
Right, sure.
Like,
you want to be pure.
Exactly.
Pure Stavros.
Pure for my pussy eating jokes.
Yeah.
You know, it is funny how serious I take it. And I look at my own act and I'm like I'm trying to write, I'm like, I got to write serious stuff. And then everything is like, the topic is like a serious thing. And then it inevitably just
ends to getting
my dick sucked.
Coming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, that's the only way my stupid brain works.
But that was like, you know, when I was coming up, there was definitely a line, you know, in terms of club comedy, like if you were blue or not blue.
Right.
And I was never a mainstream comic in that way. Like I was always dirty.
Yeah.
But there was some sort of established idea, if you were of a certain comic, that you were going to close dirty.
Right. Yeah.
It was like the Hicks thing, you know, we'll parachute on a dick joke island or whatever.
That's always how I feel. Like I still to this day, and I might on the next special try and just as a challenge to myself, I say that now. I have, you know, 7 minutes of an hour written, maybe. And I'm like, I could maybe go clean. 6 of the 7 minutes are dirty. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about.
We don't have to go clean, but you wonder, like,
could I switch something up? Could I just.
Does it all have to end with your dick?
And I think, unfortunately, it does. Unfortunately, Mark, I've done the math. I've looked at all the charts, and it does seem like it will end.
But like, I've been trying to like think about the evolution because, you know, I get sort of like looked at as some, whether it's political or liberal or whatever it is, but like, I've always been pretty dirty. Like, there's not in a lot of the specials. There's always a bit in there.
Sure.
That you know, and I used to close pretty dirty.
Yeah.
And you know, my heroes were all pretty dirty.
Totally.
And then I guess you just kind of like, as you grow up and you see who your audience is.
Right.
Because I started doing so many other things, I realized like you know I'm 60. How dirty do I need to be at 60 when I have middle-aged people in the room?
Right.
Like, I mean, they get it, but there comes
they're
a point.
They're not being prudes. They're just like, all
right,
man.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, fine. You get pussy.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're so lucky you. Yeah. You're 60, you're 60, and your dick still works. You know, we're all happy.
Right.
Do you have anything intelligent to say?
Right. And the thing is, I don't know that I ever will. Even when I'm 60, I'm just trying to have a good time, you know?
Oh, God.
That is the hard thing, is that I do think... I have, you know, I've been having a lot of these thoughts because it's like the first time I've ever slowed down.
Yeah.
And just, I've taken a little, this year I'm taking some time off. I'm just like, let me just catch my breath.
No comedy or just comedy?
No, I'm no big tour.
I'll
do some spot. I'm doing some spots and I'm actually enjoying that again because it's like the energy of
without the pressure.
Killing ahead of you and you want to do good and you want to.
That's weird. When someone's killing ahead of me, I'm going to fucking tank it. Like I never look at that as sort of like, all right.
I get that too.
Where you're just sort of like, they like him too much and I don't get it.
I sometimes will, if I'm having a bad time on the road, and you know, that's a classic, like if I'm feeling sick and I'm like, I just need things to go right. And then the guy in front of you was just killing and shouting.
Yeah.
And just like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, he's doing great. Yeah. He's act outs. Yeah. And like, I'm like, come on, man. Stop. I got the sniffles, brother. You just close it.
Well, those feature acts, it's karma for me because I think I was a pretty aggressive feature, but I didn't feature for long. I kind of went because I started in Boston doing long, you know, half hour opening gigs. So I was headlining fairly quickly.
Right.
But like I was a feature that like would, you know, and I've had features before where they're going to close with the, they're just going to build up to, it's going to be, they're all in.
I mean, I did that all too. In. And I know headliners hated me.
Yeah,
like they either loved me because they were like,
you're talking about your dick for 10 minutes.
Some guy's
trying, you know, sitting there with a button down shirt.
I know. The best though, I got to give credit. Bobby Kelly and Tom Papa were the best to me.
Well, you're not going to outfilth Bobby Kelly, but Tom Papa thing.
That's the thing. Tom loved he loved it, and he was like, and I opened for him. I was 20. The first time I opened for him was like 24.
Yeah.
Like in a little cart. I was like, all right, I'm opening for Tom Papa. I got to wear a cardigan over my graphic T-shirt.
Yeah.
and with my pussy eating jokes. And I'm like, he's going to hate me. Whatever. He loved it. His fans loved it. One lady, because I've been for Tom, both of them for years, and one lady complained once, and Tom told her to go fuck herself. It was awesome. He's the man. I mean, Papa's
the
king.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, that's funny because we're talking about this very thing, and, you know, I did that, you know, I know Bobby Kelly for years, and I know what Bobby Kelly is.
Of course.
And we're doing the Comics Come Home thing.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, it's a big lineup. It's Pescatelli and Pete Davidson's there, Lenny Clark.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of people I didn't know. Edelman, for some reason, because he comes from there.
He's from Boston.
Yeah, okay. And then Leary's reading the lineup to me. I'm like, when am I going on? He's going through all these names. And then he goes, all right, and then it's going to be Bobby Kelly, then you, and then Burr. And I'm like, what the? Why do I get it?
That's brutal. In an
the
arena.
The last three. In his hometown. He talks like them. He sounds like them. Yeah. He is of them.
Yeah.
And like, I'm not the guy that really do this, so I'm walking up to Kelly. I'm like, what are you going to do up there?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I know what he's going to do. And I thought it was coming full circle. This will be great.
Of
you know,
course.
It's going to be fun. It's 10 minutes. I can't lose. Bobby Kelly, then you.
Yeah.
And brutal. I do this bit on stage. Like, I talk about this story on stage.
No, I mean, Bobby crushes. Bobby's.
But it's also, it's like a symphony of filth.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Like, and I don't care. I of love course. What he does.
Of course.
But I got to go be thoughtful, no, which is whatever brutal. The fuck I do for
yeah,
10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I did all right because yeah. I'm a pro and I didn't let it crush me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did know going in that, like, this isn't going to be the victory.
It's not, no. This is survival. This is like, let's just get through this.
Exactly.
Let me be able to look everyone in the eye
exactly.
for the rest of the night.
That's exactly
that's
right.
That's all I need.
That's exactly yeah. right. Because I fucking.
Yeah, dude.
I fucking went up to Burr and I'm like, why do I got to follow Kelly? Why don't you follow Kelly? He goes, yeah. I want to follow Kelly. Yeah, I'm like, God, yeah. fucking damn it.
Put
how am I the buffer?
Bobby. That makes so much sense.
Why not?
Bobby's from, the, it's like crazy.
They're
like,
both from there, but yeah. you know, Burr, you can follow Burr. Bobby can follow Burr. He'll follow anybody.
They can both follow, but I get it, yeah.
Oh, God, the closing bit, it was just like, it was more than I ever imagined. Because when I was told I was going to follow him, I'm like, oh my God, this is like, I know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But boy, it was at a level that I couldn't even.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know.
I mean, yeah, I get it. I know. I mean, I remember, because that's, I'm like, you know, I'm coming out of Baltimore, and Bobby took me on the road, and, you know, I would like be, I like doing both alt and club
yeah,
stuff.
Sure.
I was kind of doing both.
Yeah.
But to Bobby, I'm like, you know, the altist, you know, I'm a communist. I'm like the most left.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, you know, and I'm, you know, soft, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty good. I can do, and to just watch Bobby in a club.
Yeah.
Especially in Boston.
Yeah.
Like, there are times where I'm just like, oh, I'm not doing the same thing. Yeah. I'm not doing, like, I'm not even close. And, you know, you're 25, so you think you're better than you
yeah,
are. And
yeah,
all this
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
So it was so great to just be on the road with him because I'm like, oh, it reminded me that I'm like, my best set I've ever had for 3 minutes, I've reached like Bobby at cruising
yes,
speed.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it was like, it was great to just have to
see a real killer.
Just see, and Papa too. It was just like, it was good to see these guys
totally
like
different.
Crushing totally in totally different ways. And they both, we would learn so much from both of them. Cause it's
well,
like,
that's
you know,
like, those are the opposite ends of the craft spectrum.
Yeah.
You know, cause, you know, Papa is so meticulous.
Yeah,
and his timing and his structure.
And every bit has like a thesis.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got bam, 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 and then a conclusion. I mean, literally yeah. watching.
And
was
Bobby's
like,
just like, gah, 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 gah. You know.
It was awesome.
Oh, my God.
But yeah.
So when did you, like, how long did you kick around Baltimore?
I moved right around that time when I started opening for those guys. I was like, because in my, again, you're like, well, now I'm a working comic.
You
I'm
moved to where?
New York.
Yeah.
To Astoria. This,
oh, that's
this when
you
I
moved
come
there.
To, your,
yeah, yeah.
to your bed-bug-ridden yeah. apartment right yeah, around yeah. then. And so, yeah, I don't graduate. They let me walk because if you have less than 8 credits, they assume you're going to finish in summer school.
Sure.
And I just wanted my mom to get the picture of me in the gown.
Yeah.
So I still, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, I have every credit except my language credits.
And that one you could breeze through if you
I
tell them.
I could take a test. I could go take a test whenever, but I think it's funny not to have your, to almost
it
get
it. Was
it
haunting to me.
It.
I was undergrad for 5 years and I had an incomplete and I was yeah. like, oh my God.
It still gets to you?
Well, I mean, I finished it. But
oh,
I mean,
you did
like,
finish
yeah,
it.
I finished it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, I like not finishing it. It makes me feel, I have a weird sense of superiority. Where it's like, I don't give a fuck. I could do it right now. I'm not going to.
I did life without it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, look at me.
I lied when I needed to get day jobs. I just said I graduated. Nobody
Why
fucking
not?
Checked.
You just show them the picture.
Yeah, yeah. Here's me shaking hands with the chancellor. Would a non-graduate have access
have,
to this?
Yeah, do you have a diploma? Look at the picture. Yeah. What is he handing me?
And so I moved... I move when I'm, yeah, when I'm 25, 26 to New
so
York.
So what's going on there? So you're doing like, because like by the time I left New York, whatever alt scene that I was involved in was the original one, but then it became very established. Like I've never set foot in the creek in the cave.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It wasn't there.
It was, I kind of caught it at the tail end.
Of
probably,
the alt thing?
Of that scene, because that was like,
my scene, like
time.
Eugene Merman still had the... What was it called?
He did the festival, right? The Eugene Merman Festival.
Well, he did, but there was a room they used to do. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I caught the tail end of a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
It was kind of weird. I mean, you know, I did most of my, I would play, you know, the alt rooms in New York, but it was just like, it wasn't really an alt scene. It was just like, you had clubs, and then it was literally everything else, right? It was
yeah,
Brooklyn
because
and just anywhere.
But something morphed at some point. Like, it's weird because, like, alt seemed to fragment, you know, into just these rooms. But, like, you know, the guys, like, you know, look, I know, you know, Big J and I know Kurt and I, you know, and they were kind of the ones behind me and I love those guys. But then at some point it became a little more tribal. Like, you know, there was the Skankfest guys.
Sure, and then
there were the women with, you know, the bangs doing, the more quieter, thoughtful people.
So,
you know, it definitely broke up somehow.
Maybe I'm overthinking. I think you're overthinking it because I always thought of it as like I moved at a time where everybody was kind of finding their footing.
Yeah.
And the other thing is a lot of those people all started at the same time. A lot of them are still friends. Like I do. I mean, I like I'll go to all those rooms and I still I like doing that. I like that it's not maybe it's a little tribal, but I like that there's different types of rooms you can go to. Where shit's working.
There was like not an agenda. Like when I was looking, you know, when I looked at you up, like, you know, and I'm associated with politics on some level, but I didn't even know what the fuck the Dirtbag Left was until today.
Well, that's I mean, so when I moved a couple after like a year or two, me and my buddies, Nick Mullen and Adam Friedland, we started Cumtown, our podcast.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing that popped.
I think I know Nick Mullen.
Nick's hilarious.
Yeah.
Super funny guy.
Oh, he's a funny guy.
Super funny.
Yeah.
Really like, and we had an, I mean, that show was, we got successful, again, by accident. My whole career has felt like something that's
so when you get in, so you're doing these rooms in New York and podcasting is just a thing just starting?
It was literally, here's how I felt about it.
So it's Cumtown Audio?
It was audio. We were like, you know, video, no nothing. And honestly, my thoughts were, I was like, podcasting's over.
Right.
I was like, Marin, Comedy Bang Bang, This American Life. That was it. It's done.
Yeah.
And Mullen was fucking right. And he was like, let's just do it. I thought for sure we would do like 7 episodes.
Yeah.
That's every comic was doing that at the time.
Right.
They would do 10 episodes.
They'd see 9 people listened and they quit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then we just... I think the reason we even associated with the Dirtbag Left at all is because Nick was roommates with a couple people that were in Chapo Trap House.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, we, and you know, I happen to have, I'm not really super political in my act or even, but if something comes up, I'll talk, I won't shy away from talking about it. My comedy's a lot more just like interpersonal. I'm so personally driven that if you pay attention, you could probably see what my politics are.
Well, that's me too. I know I can't talk from anywhere but my own point of view.
Right. And so, you know, the whole political thing is very funny because I think just by having friends who are
aligned
or political, that it's like we just got kind of, we were just friends with them. And same thing, I have a friend, you know, friends who are, that's their thing is being political, Twitch streaming, political stuff like that. But yeah, for us, and so it's funny that our show ever got aligned with any politics because if you listen to the show, the whole point is just like the dumbest, having fun with your friends, and it's like middle school.
And talking
about
sex?
When you would just say, not even sex.
Yeah.
It's dumber than that.
Yeah.
I mean, we talk about sex too, but it would be like, it's just shitting on each other.
Sure.
You know, stream of consciousness bits, saying, you know, it's kind of what you're saying about being 60 and being dirty. I kind of felt like, well, it was, we in our 20s, being the Cumtown guys was awesome, but it's like, we're going to be 40 and being the Cumtown guys,
you know?
So we're all doing our own shit now. They got the Adam Friedland show, which is really funny. And I did my own podcast that's a little more, it's advice.
Yeah.
It's advice plus interview
still
stuff.
Doing it?
I still do. I still do Stabby's World,
And it's video, though?
Video, yeah.
Yeah. You made the jump.
I made the jump, brother. Yeah. Because it really was just, I wanted to make something that I could just do. My issue with podcasting was that, well, when you're doing it with two other guys and everything is sort of like your dynamic, you can't really pre-record shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I wanted to go on the road. We all wanted to kind of do our own shit.
Yeah.
And so it was like, we're doing 5 episodes in 2 days, but it's like the same guys talking about the
same
shit.
So you shoot, you do it at a time and you do call-in?
I do a bunch at a time. I have a guest. I have a friend. If you're ever in New York, you want to do the show, we'd love to have you. And then we just, and then people call in with their voicemails.
So we reply to there.
And then we do a Patreon episode where they call in directly.
Yeah.
And that's really fun to be able to just talk to people. Yeah. And, you know.
That's interesting though what you said about, you know, where you are personally politically and then what you do on stage, because for me, that's always been the mix that you got to pull off.
Sure.
Is that, you know, you're going to, if you're going to, for me, and you don't seem to want to do it, which is fine, but like, you know, I have politics, how they run through me.
Sure.
And what my interpretation is. But I'd be careful. You know, I'm always sort of like, I always want to ground it in the fact that, you know, I'm an imperfect person with problems.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah, yeah.
But,
oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
I do think about this.
Totally, totally. Yeah. And I do. And I do think on some level, I guess, I also like to think of it holistically of like, that is still a passion of mine. And I still think inequality in this country is out of, you know, incredibly out of control. And the stuff I went to school for, public policy, and I mostly was focusing on welfare policy. Yeah. But I just know that if I was really serious about those things, I would have fucking gone to, you know, studied more, gotten a job.
And had like a thankless civil
exactly. I mean,
service.
I was
type
a tutor
of-
in Baltimore City for a couple of years when I was open micing. And when I quit, I was like, I have to quit because I'm not pouring my whole being into this.
Yeah, and also, when, like, know, when you have ego or you want to, you know, be recognized
totally.
For what you're doing,
yep.
I mean, that's a pretty thankless world. Like, I got pretty obsessed with social workers, and, like, no one ever talks about them, and they're kind of holding things together barely.
It's crazy.
You know, it's an amazing—
You should literally triple what they make.
And teachers, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess the way I look at it is— I poured myself into getting good at stand-up.
Yeah.
And I do think there will be kind of a later, like I'm even kind of thinking about, I got a place in Baltimore. My family still lives there. So I'm spending a little more time there this year, just kind of hanging out with them, reconnecting with stuff. And I was like, you know, I want to do some, you know, charity work in Baltimore.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason I do comedy is because I had a teacher in like second and third grade who was like, he was doing community theater.
Yeah.
They would put on these great things. He let me host the talent show when I'm in third grade.
Yeah.
So I'm up there like riffing when it's like one of my positive memories. So it's like, I want to go back and like help out that way. But I do think that's, to me right now, it's a little separate from my output. You know, it's not, I don't think I can communicate the ideas that I'm passionate about in a way that's also funny, because I am very staunchly on the, like, I'm a laughs per minute guy. I'm a, like, and that's maybe why I want to do maybe a little acting or write something, do a show, because you can be a little more interested. You could more complex ideas that way. Whereas I think stand-up, I love it. It's my favorite thing.
Depends
in the world.
Depends what your audience is. And like, you know, lately
true,
I've been
that's
sort
true.
Of, you know what I mean? Because you you do build, when you get an audience, you have manifested it.
True.
So you're looking at a reflection of some kind.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then, it, you know, you have to decide, like, is this who I am? That guy?
Right.
But oddly, you know, despite my, you know, lifelong attempt to self-sabotage myself.
Yeah.
You know, I've got these, you know, grown-up, you know, smart, kind of, you know, decent people at my shows. And like lately I've been like, are you sure?
Yeah.
Like there's part of me that's sort of like, let me show you who I really
am. Let's get into it.
Yeah, but I always have.
Yeah.
And they're still there. And I think that, well, not unlike anything else, you know, people hear what they want to hear. They make judgments
about, that's a good
point. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it all depends on how you tip it. But I think that, you know, being honest and being base or being filthy, you know, is as much part of the human condition as anything else. And the
relief
that you can get out of people and yourself by sort of, you know, sharing those things, you know, it's genuine humanity.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true. That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And it's the thing everybody does get. Whether you want to say
that's right.
Somebody
farts are funny.
Yeah, farts. You know. Yeah, absolutely. Sex. All the stuff.
Yeah.
All that. Like the. That's why these things just do hit the hardest when it comes to stand up.
And now, like, unfortunately, you know, despite no one's best effort, you know, information technology has really successfully broken almost everyone's brain.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's fucked.
It's super.
And
fucked.
They, you know, our brains aren't meant to manage what we get out of that thing.
No.
You know, and it's like, it's kind of crazy. So you can have this experience with these people, but they go home and you don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's, you don't know what they're doing. And you're right. We kind of obsess over, you know, your act, what you're going to do, whatever. Yeah. But it's like, this is one, most people, even diehard fans will see you, what, four times in their life?
Right.
Diehards.
That's right.
You know,
they don't know what you're doing with the other. You know,
yeah. And it's like, who knows what. And then you said it too, where it's like, you don't know what they're taking out of.
Yeah.
The thing you might want to put out,
yeah,
they don't even give a fuck about it.
Yeah.
And there's just something they like about,
that's
something intrinsic about you that they just like.
That's
they want
right.
to hear you talk.
Right.
When it comes down
right.
to it.
Right.
Know?
No, but it's interesting to me, though, because this is the other component that, you know, I'm starting to realize is that, there's still some part of you that wants to write a show? I mean, like, it seems to me, like, here's my premise, is that
maybe more than shows.
You seem to be, you're of a generation where I start to realize, like, look, I don't have a YouTube presence.
Yeah.
So, like, when I do a special, you know, I want to be paid by, you know, a network or a platform. I want them to give me the money. And then, you know, I don't need to know how many people watch it.
So, absolutely.
But, like, because I know, because I have no presence, if I did a special I put it on YouTube, I'd be sitting there every day. I'm like, how could only 100 people you know, watch this? You know? So I don't want, I'm in denial, and that's fine.
Sure.
And, but it seems to me that there's all these, you know, everyone's building their own show business.
True.
What mainstream show business is, or what it was when I was coming up, you know, you go pitch, you get a show, you do this or that. People don't give a fuck anymore.
I guess that's true. I guess what I meant was like something narrative that's not stand up.
Yeah.
But not necessarily.
No, I'm just asking in terms of like, how do you see show business?
Well, how I see show business is that, I think that's exactly how I view it. My YouTube channel, I view it as like my own network.
Yeah.
That's what I'm building, right? And I like that. I like that I have control over it. I mean, I am a little worried because YouTube was supposed to be this, it's free from all these network restrictions, whatever. But now they're getting every huge tech company, you know, they start to censor a little more, and they want things a little cleaner because they make their money off advertising. So inevitably, we will have to make an exodus from YouTube as well. Yeah. But that's not where we are now.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it is about having the ability to having your own fans so that even let's say you put something out with a network or you put something out as, you know, in theaters or whatever. Yeah. Basically, show business is one gigantic bringer, and that's it. There's no pretense that it's not. There's no, there's no way to, and maybe you could.
As an entrepreneur, it's a bringer. Yeah, if it's old school show business, it's just a numbers game.
Right.
And now they've had to adapt to sort of giving people opportunities who already have, you know, a following.
Yeah.
Just to meet their bottom line. They don't give a fuck. They might not even know you, but they look at the numbers and they're like, absolutely. Well, what do you want to do?
And it becomes a thing of like every relationship is like, you just have to be getting something out of it where you have to build up you're never going to, the way I look at it is you're never going to develop through a network. You're never going to get your opportunities there
anymore.
You have to create that yourself.
Yes.
And that then it becomes pure business where it's like, can we do something here?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was a little nervous when I put a special out on Netflix because you don't know anything about a huge, I'd never done anything with a network.
Was that the
network,
new one?
The new one, right?
What's it called again?
Fat Rascal
on
Netflix right now. Because, you know, I had done, my whole career was the internet. You know what I mean? I did whatever the fuck I wanted.
Yeah.
And, but it's Netflix, it's the biggest streamer, and I want more people to see my shit. It did great. Did really well. I was really happy with it. They were happy with it. And they didn't restrict me at all. They restricted me probably less than YouTube would have.
Right.
And they were great to work with. I was, you know, and it was like, not that I didn't expect it, but it's like, you know, you just expect the man. You're like, fuck.
Sure.
You know, fuck you. You know, all you're is suits, right?
And but my point is that in terms of something doing well, it's all relative to their fucking algorithm, right? So you could get lost or you could not. And you don't even know. So, you know, really.
Sure. Sure, and that is true. I mean, but I just think that putting something, it just goes to, are you getting something with a lot of viewership, or are you getting money? You just have to make it worth your while one way or another. But there's no, but and then you have to always have the ability to walk away and be like, I'll just fucking do it myself.
Yeah,
and that's also why, I mean, when we stopped Cumtown, part of me was like, I don't really want to do a podcast.
Yeah,
but with just a couple months, I was like, it's so important to just have your own fans forever. And a podcast is the best way to just kind of keep them weekly, giving them something, getting to interact with them.
But you're not crazy with the content. I mean, do you feel like you're overwhelmed in terms of what you have to feed?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. I mean, the overhead is high.
Yeah.
I have buddies that I've, you know, I mean, it's cool because I've gotten to hire my friends.
Right.
But, you know, we have to put out a lot of fucking shit. And it is like you're running a network. And you're not making that much money off it. Everything goes to touring. So it's just like, it's like a Jenga tower of like, everything has to just support the touring business.
So they know where you are and when you're going to be there and you stay in their face.
Yeah. And then if I wanted to put something out, right, let's say I do want to write that show.
Yeah.
And either I go with a network because maybe they just give us a bigger budget than I can afford, or have access to like
different type of ad support.
Yeah, whatever it is, like that way, or fuck it and we just make our own thing. Then at the end of the day, if I go directly to those people, I know they exist. I know someone's going to be interested.
And breaking even is not terrible.
Not terrible, especially if you're making money on the road.
Right.
Right. Like that's really, it's kind of what musicians have been up against since Napster, basically, it's like, everything is your fucking touring business.
Right.
And I happen to like touring. I mean, I'd like to do it in a way that's healthy for me, and I'm figuring that out right now.
Yeah, you can
but
do
I
it.
Do like it.
Yeah.
And there is something to going back to, like, not to sound corny about phones and shit, but it's like there still just is nothing like live performance, and there is nothing like every show having its own energy connection to people, and that is, at the end of the day, the more I've taken a couple months and thought about it, it's like, I still just love stand-up comedy. I just do. In a club, the most.
The best,
like, You know?
Yeah, and I just did two sets of Dry Heat Comedy Club in Albuquerque because I grew up there.
That's
there's
awesome.
Like 50 people, and
it's great.
I just dropped in. But the weird thing is that because of, and you probably, you know, you work within this because you seem to record a lot of club sets.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, when you do a show, if I go do an hour, like, say, tomorrow in Montclair, New Jersey, wherever, Thursday, and something happens, like, you know, I love it, and it's great, and it makes it worthwhile, and it's what I set out to do, but you walk off going, like, nah, no one, it's gone.
No clip. Yeah. Yeah. But that's beautiful. See, I also philosophically have been thinking about this a lot, because I also recognize, like, doing clips was an accident. It was just, I put out my own YouTube special, and I didn't have much. I had a small YouTube presence, but nothing crazy.
Yeah.
And I had been trying to get a Comedy Central half hour.
Yeah.
So I recorded every set to watch it. And so I just had all these random moments that normally I'd be like, are gone.
Yeah.
And I never set out to be a crowd work clip guy, but I just had a year's worth of them.
But were there crowd work clip guys when you did that, or were you kind of, did you set a certain standard?
I think it was kind of starting, but it was like, don't get me wrong, I was like a material, you know, I was precious about my material, and so I was like, fuck it, I'll put out some stuff, and within a couple of days, I was out of material to put out, because I was like, well, the rest of it's got to go on the fucking hour.
That's right, you don't burn it.
So I was like, all right, let's just do this, and so it was kind of accidental. But I do think there is, and it's helped me tremendously. And I view these clips as like an advertisement.
Right.
I don't see them as my comedy. I see them as like, if it's either this or something.
It'll make
bullshit.
People want to see you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's either, but I think there is a toll you pay in putting enough of that out there. Because that's also, that does affect the live show. Because if people had no idea.
Oh, they just want that the whole time.
Well, it's not even just that. That it's not that big a deal. It's not as big a deal as people think, because usually it's one dickhead who really wants to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And you could just destroy him.
Yeah.
And it's fun for you
and, it's
and everybody
for
else. And they actually hate it. Do it to a point where they're not having a good time. That one guy. Yeah. And then he's the sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
But I just think there's, from a performance aspect, you are giving away a lot of yourself and a lot of what is special about you as a performer.
Right.
But at the same time, because they are so ethereal.
Yeah.
And because I do like getting into it with the crowd, because I hope that my crowd work isn't like the, like, hey, nice shirt, you fucking bitch. You know, like it's a little,
no,
I actually like
not.
To ask questions and
into it. If it happens organically, it's great. Cause you don't know where it's going to go.
Yeah.
It keeps you on your feet and you might actually discover something.
But that's the thing is, like, now I'm at this point where I'm trying to write this hour and I'm like, wait, is that a clip or should I build on that? Like, I am having those problems to the point where I think I'm just not going to put out a lot of stuff.
Well, that's where I write on stage.
You know,
so I have to have the things have to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they keep adding to themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't do the clips. So I imagine that would be a big problem for me, is sort of like, oh, that bit's so much better now.
Yeah.
That's like a whole bit.
And I feel bad for comics who are, because look, I at least was lucky in that I was overdue, I think, to put something out. I had never put out anything but a 5-minute thing before I did my first special. And I've been doing comedy for, I think, 11 or 12 years by the time it came out. So, you know, I think I was at least formed to a certain degree. I do feel bad for a lot of, because I remember moments that I thought when I was younger were fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
That if I put them out, I would be fucking mortified. And I see kids doing, like,
I see them doing that now. You're putting up open mic sets.
And they feel like they should. So I do feel bad. And maybe this is just, you know, maybe this is just me being old. Because everybody just does get old.
Yeah.
And maybe this is just the way shit is going to go. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I do feel like you should kind of toil in obscurity for a while, right, and not do shit and bomb and maybe have magic moments. But they're not as good as you think they are. But let them exist in your head as like something to push you forward to really get to it. Because, you know, I just do think you do just pay a toll. You're giving... There's no way putting out that much stuff doesn't affect quality in some way.
Right.
You know, maybe if you work hard enough, you can overcome it.
Yeah.
But even I'm starting to feel it now after it's been a couple of years. And if I were to look at the number of minutes that I've put out, it's just too many minutes.
Yeah.
It's too many fucking minutes. Yeah, it's like I've done 2-hour specials plus a ten minute long clips every week plus the short clips. It's like it's probably over like 5 hours, six hours.
Yeah,
just too much output. And I'm not that good. I'm not that talented. You know, like, and so, you know, I'm thinking about that going forward and like what I want to do. But hey man, at the end of the day, fucking clips got me, you know,
playing theaters.
I'm in the theater. I bought a fucking, you know, got my mom a new dishwasher. We're looking good, you know?
All right.
Things are going good.
It was great talking to you, man.
Great talking to you, man. Thanks for having me.
Yep. There you go. Love that guy. You can get his podcast, Stavi's World, wherever you get your podcasts, and at Patreon for exclusive members-only content. Hang out for a minute, folks.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Folks, it was 5 years ago on July 7th, 2019, we posted an amazing conversation with David Lee Roth. It's episode 1034, and you can get it right now in all podcast feeds.
My first singing teacher had two numbers on his forearm. One was his camp number, and the other was his orchestra number.
Huh.
And as a punk kid, I once asked him in front of the class, I said, so what happens if you didn't sing good? And he was very explicit. He said, if you didn't sing good, you went up the chimneys. I think of that every single time I sing, every single time I get ready to sing, every time my inner child goes, fuck it, you don't need to sing. Don't worry about it. You'll sing fine. Wow. I remember that. And I remember, I think it was Ricky Weiss or whatever. Jesus, we were 13, 12 years old, saying to him, I remember him saying to me more than once, Mr. Roth, if you can't find it within yourself to sing on behalf of those who went up the chimneys with a song in their hearts, sing so you don't go up the chimneys.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And that's where that fire for Run with the Devil. How long are we going to dance? We're going to dance the night away. Hey, how about these words? Let's jump. Okay? Oh, they're all verbs. Think about that. All right? We're going to run with the devil. Are we talking about love? No, we ain't talking about love. And by the way, do you jog? No, I run. Who do you run with? The devil.
That's David Lee Roth on episode 1034. To get all WTF episodes ad-free, sign up for WTF Plus. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And just a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's some old guitar.
Boomer lives, and Monkey, and LaFonda, and the Cat Angels are coming down. They're coming down. They're coming down.